Welcome to Ear Biscuits. I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link. This week at the round table of dim lighting, we're gonna talk about the future with Derek Muller, known everywhere on the internet as Veritasium, amazing YouTube creator and scientifically minded person who is, we have had a very stimulating conversation.
We have had it.
We've had it, and we're teeing it up for you, Ear Biscuiteer. A lot of fun for us to speculate about things that will happen in the future. And I know that it's striking. It's speaking your love language.
I like to talk about the future. I like to talk about the future with people who know things about the future and actually have informed guesses about the future, as opposed to myself that just has formed guesses about the future. You know what I'm saying?
Formed meaning you formed it, meaning you made them up.
Meaning I formed them, meaning I got lots of guesses about the future and I have formulated them, but they're not informulated necessarily.
So we get into a lot of things in our conversation with Derek, and we also clear up, I will say that you're the one who made it awkward. But I think we cleared up something that was a little an interpersonal conflict between Derek and
I. If you want to lay blame here, blame number one responsible party is Derek.
Oh, okay.
Number two responsible party is you because of the way you reacted. And I'm just saying technical responsibility. He's the one who started
it. Like scientific responsibility.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean, but then you got very close second because of the way you took it. And now I'm just a guy who likes to be entertained. I'm third on this totem pole, man. I'm third.
You need to invert that.
Okay.
Entirely.
All right.
You, then me, then Derek.
You can do that if you want.
But it was fun and it was interesting and it might have been a little awkward. I mean, his mom was watching, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, that's what was gonna be so great. I wanted her to come out and referee.
So that's what you got in store for you as you're listening tonight. I feel like you're listening at night for some reason to this one.
Now you just alienated everyone who doesn't listen at night.
Even if it's during the day, it's just—
It's night somewhere.
It's night in your soul right now.
Oh gosh.
We're listening in your—
That's the worst.
You're listening in your ear.
Night of the soul is like, dark night of the soul is, that's a bad thing, man.
So we talked about cars.
Cars.
And I didn't mention this, but we can get into it a little bit more. Neil's got a vehicle.
Well, pretty big deal here.
A replacement vehicle for the illustrious minivan.
Now, I haven't talked to you about this, but I wanted to—
And it does something that is very futuristic.
Right, but we'll talk about that later, because the thing that the most interesting aspect of this is the fact that you un-minivanned, which is a, you know, minivanning as a decision is already a bit of a decision, right? I've never made that decision. And then you un-minivanned. And I just wanna know what went into—
It's interesting.
What went into the process.
I mean, I've been a proud minivanner for many years, maybe 7 years, maybe more than that.
More than that.
I've been through three minivans.
You got one right after you had your first kid.
Oh yeah.
So, I mean—
No, I didn't. Did I?
You had a minivan—
With a second kid, bro.
Definitely with Lincoln, so we're talking 12 years.
Which two kids does not require a minivan. So yeah, we made a choice to go for it for the spaciousness. And
the drivability, man. It drives like a car. It fits a lot of people in it. It's very practical.
You can get a lot of people in it. I remember right when we got it, we went on a whitewater rafting trip and it was me, my dad, you, Greg, Greg's dad, and another person. And I was like, oh, we'll take the minivan.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's perfect.
And while I appreciate all that, I have a certain level of pride. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I only had two kids, so I didn't need a minivan.
You let the stigma get to you.
Minivans have a stigma.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the way that our families work is that, you know, we've got the car that we typically drive, and then you've got the car that your wife typically drives, and she's gonna be the one that has the bigger one because she's picking up the kids from school and more often dealing with them than we are during the day. But then—
Oh, I wouldn't be caught dead driving a minivan, just me. That's crazy.
No, but I'm just saying that like there are moments, and I'm not saying this is a healthy thing, but there are just times when I'm in a place and I don't want people to just pigeonhole me as the guy with the minivan. So that's the reason that I recognize how practical it is. So I was just like, I'm gonna get an SUV that basically is, I know it's not as convenient, it's harder to get in and out of all these things, but it was just a sense of external appearance that keeps a lot of people from going to the minivan.
You made a shallow choice to not get a minivan.
Yeah, but because—
I made a deep choice.
But because the— that's,
to get a minivan.
But that is the way the world works, because people are shallow, and so sometimes you have to make shallow decisions to live in a shallow world.
Okay, that if that makes you feel better.
And you've now made a shallow decision.
Well, I'll say that years of being minivan driver, I think, got to us. So like we could only fight that good fight so long. And one day, Christian and I were just sitting down, and there was a, just we weren't, you know, it's just one of those like silent moments.
Kids, silent moment.
The kids aren't around. Here we are just sitting down.
A moment of reflection.
And then it's, yeah, I think it turned reflection-y, reflective. And then—
I like reflection-y. Could you, just use that
and
word,
then
please.
All of a sudden, Christy was like, I wouldn't like another minivan.
Oh, it was her.
It got to her, and I was like,
"I would." Did she say it? Hold on. Did she phrase it exactly that way? Because that it sounds so. I wouldn't like another minivan. Like that's an interesting way to say. Or did you just say that right now?
I did say it right now. I heard myself say it. I think that was her sentiment. I can't. I you know I don't remember conversations.
I'm willing to bet she did not just out of the blue say, "I wouldn't like another minivan."
And then I was like, "I too am in agreement."
Guys are weird. In your reflectionary moments. Moments.
We were both feeling it. You know, like the minivan was getting a lot of miles. Once it breaks 100,000 miles, you gotta replace the transmission in that puppy.
Yeah.
And I did that twice.
100,000.
And I was like, I am not doing that again.
That's when the problems really start.
So then when we were gonna get in, I was like, we're breaking 100 grand in terms of miles, not in terms of—
we're gonna spend 100 grand on a minivan.
That is quite a minivan.
It's got gold rims.
100,000 miles, we gotta get out from under this. We gotta shed this skin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're like, well, let's not get another minivan.
But was there a discussion beyond that, or was it just a feeling during a reflectiony moment? Where you just—
that was
like,
it. We were in agreement.
You vibed, yeah. We're not gonna—
yeah,
get—
we
a
were
minivan.
Vibing about it. And then so we wanted that. I mean, with three kids, we wanted a car that had captain's chairs in the second row. So then basically we just picked an SUV that had captain's chairs in the second row so that the kids wouldn't be in a bench seat. They have to have physical separation. They have to have their own seat or it's just gonna be bad. It can't be like—
oh, that's— it's not about access to the back row. It's about physical separation.
That's the first reason is everyone has their own seat and it's not two people on a big bench that then, it's like, well, how much of the bench are you taking? I just didn't wanna have that argument. So that narrowed down what we were gonna go with. And I don't even wanna say what we bought because A, they're not paying me, and B, I don't care enough to say, honestly. But I am tempted to, brag a little bit because it's got an auto parking feature.
Well, I mean, okay.
And I didn't really know that cars had this because I have a minivan with 100,000 miles on it.
Right, but I saw like a Nissan commercial from like 7 years ago where they were advertising this technology.
And I probably saw it and I was like, that's stupid. I can park my own car. One of the things that I took the most pride in when I first started dating Christy was my ability to park in a space on a date, and I would always back in.
You're a back inner.
I would back in, and she was really impressed with that. I would always back in my 1987 Nissan
doesn't
pickup.
Doesn't take much, does it?
Shut up. That sounded like you insulted my wife. Or I can't figure out, did you insult me or my wife?
I'm just saying, a woman who's really impressed by a man who backs in, I'm just saying.
Take it back. don't insult my wife on
a
podcast.
I'm insulting—
insult me.
I'm insulting you through your wife. That's the way I went at it that time.
Well, I don't appreciate it.
Okay, I take it all back. In.
What? I didn't even hear
it. I said I take it all back. In. because you're back in. It was actually an incredible joke, and everyone in the room laughed. But you didn't get it because you're spending too much time thinking about backing into spaces so you can get out quick.
And that's what matters, that you said something funny, not the apology. That's fine.
Yeah.
So anyway, this car, when it parks automatically, it does it by backing only. Did you know that? That self-parking cars back in exclusively, or at least this one.
It will not go into a, because I know it parallel parks, but it also goes into a regular space.
A proper parallel parking procedure is to back in.
Right.
The physics of how a car works, right. Nose first, doesn't work nearly as well.
But you can't even choose to pull into a space.
Yeah, it'll automatically park in parking spaces that are like normal, like cars beside each other, not end to end, but side by side.
Well,
but it will only back into those. And it's a scary thing, and it feels awesome. But I've lost a little bit of myself. I've given myself over, and that's what we talked about when we talk about the future, is how much of ourselves are we gonna give over to the robot overlords? We discussed that in depth.
Well, it makes
I've broken the seal personally now.
Well, it makes me think that maybe, again, because we talk about this as well, about how I have this faith in AI helping us be able to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've basically proven here, Link,
yeah,
is that at least with your car, the AI has determined that the best way to get into a spot is to back in, which might potentially settle our long-standing argument.
And I'm trying to make up for insulting my wife. I will accept it.
I'm willing.
Yes.
I think you're missing the bigger point here.
Finally,
whole point.
I've been right the whole time.
The whole point of appealing to AI is that it is something beyond the two people and their flawed understandings can achieve. Now, if there's other cars out there that don't just exclusively back in, then you know, I'm gonna take it all back. But at least as far as this particular car company that I'm not gonna mention is concerned, and this particular model that you have is concerned, if that's the AI we're deferring to.
I love it.
You win the argument for now.
Yep.
Until I get a car that pulls in.
This episode of Ear Biscuits is supported by HelloFresh.
HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate.
Here's how it works. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes to make for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks, short on time. And you know what? The thing we love is that the kids get involved. Lily loves cooking stuff. And this is very empowering for her to cook for the whole family and not waste anything. You know, like all the ingredients are there, and try new things she's never had. Even Lando gets involved. He likes to cook stuff now because of the HelloFresh box.
Well, what'd you have this week?
Oven roasted Mediterranean cauliflower, because we picked the veggie option with tzatziki and chili cumin oil.
Oh.
I mean, that's something that I don't think we would have ever eaten. But then it's like, whoa, this is great. And we made it.
Well, we had something that took me back home. Carolina barbecue chicken with mac and cheese and green beans. Pretty simple, classic meal. We did not let the kids get involved because that's when things go wrong. And it has nothing to do with the instructions. It just has to do with just the tendencies of my children. Because the recipes are very simple. I can follow them. I don't spend a lot of time cooking, but I don't have to spend a lot of time cooking with this. Easy to follow directions. Now, HelloFresh delivers food to your doorstep in a recyclable, insulated box for free, and this all comes out to less than $10 a meal.
Yeah, so Mythical Beast, we have a deal for you. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, all you gotta do is visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code EAR30. That's HelloFresh.com, enter promo code EAR30.
Remember, supporting our sponsors like HelloFresh is a great way to support Ear Biscuits. Now, on with the biscuit.
I remember it was a bus and it was the daytime and that's where we met. So it was some YouTube event.
Oh.
And then there were guys who created weird vehicles, and they had like a YouTube channel, but they had an accent. But I don't know.
Yeah, they were Australian.
They were Australian.
They were these guys who do Mighty Car Mods.
And you knew them.
Yeah,
or
them. I'm also kind of Australian.
Kind of.
Yeah, I was born there. But I don't have the accent. Right. Well, I can try to put one on if you like.
Well, I mean, you just do it.
It's too late now.
That would really annoy.
As you please.
That would really annoy.
Did you ever have it? Did you ever have the
accent? No, because I moved away when I was like 18 months old. We moved to Canada, so I'm essentially Canadian. But then I moved back when I was 21 and lived there for a decade. But I think by the time you're 21, you've got your accent. You know what it's going to be.
Well, now there are different kinds of people because there are definitely people
who are
no, there are people who are adults.
Well, that's the type.
Adults who go to a place, like I had, I don't even remember who this was, but I've had multiple friends who like just went on a European vacation and they come back talking differently.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, God. It's just like people who are just so, they can be influenced so easily.
I mean, or they want to sound that way. I had a friend who went to London for like 6 months and came back and everything was like, oh, a cup of high tea.
It's like, you got to guard against that. You got to go in guarding against
that.
And we just met your mom. She's here.
She is indeed. Yeah, she's a wonderful,
keeping an eye on
wonderful
you.
Person.
She's visiting, keeping an eye on you here, making sure we don't get you in any trouble here on this Ear Biscuit. if my mom was visiting and this wasn't my show, I don't know if I would bring my mom to it because I just think she would, when it was over, she'd try to be nice, but she would just be like, it's so boring.
Yeah.
I don't
think my mom would care too much about coming to a podcast, but she wanted to go to the doctors last time. Remember that?
She needed to see a doctor?
No, the doctors, the show.
Okay, yeah.
And she took Christy and Jesse.
She loved it.
Yeah.
She loved it, but she didn't ask to sit in on a podcast. No.
But you know, like if my mom has a superpower, it's making everything seem the best version of itself. You know, like I could do anything here. This could be an awful podcast that we could do, and she would still walk out with glowing reviews. That I can guarantee you.
Oh, wow.
You're going to go back and brag to your friends at your high school reunion that you're going to next.
She is absolutely going to do that. And if we can get a link and stuff, you know, she will be sharing that around the that crowd.
We'll give you some business cards. You can't just push Derek's channel anymore. You gotta push.
Yeah, that's right.
Some Good Mythical Morning and some Ear Biscuits amongst your friends. You know, put in a good word for us. I'll try really hard to be entertaining right now, more than usual on this podcast.
And we are trying to break into that demo, the demo that's currently going to their 50-year high school reunion. That's, we hear they got a lot of purchasing power.
Oh yeah. She been buying you stuff?
No.
Okay, she's saving it up. She's gonna buy some of our merch.
Okay, now I don't know if Link wants to bring this up, so I feel like I can be the mediator here.
Oh,
but
I think I know what this is.
Yeah,
actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, really?
There's some beef.
Yeah, there's a little bit of beef.
But did I talk about this?
You know what? You did mention it because I could tell it was on your mind. It was
to you?
Yeah.
Because I don't remember that.
I know. You know, I could see it in your eyes a little bit the next time I saw you. But also, you know, I felt bad about it.
We got to give him the backstory.
When it happened, yeah. I mean.
Oh, man.
But.
This is good.
We haven't talked about.
I think we have.
I think I did mention something. Because there's no way that you would have known.
There was some kind of follow-up.
Well, you can tell it from your perspective.
I didn't even know it happened when it happened. You told me about it later.
This is how I remember it.
Yep.
It was VidCon. And so VidCon's kind of crazy. Like we were, I'm pretty sure we were introducing people on the main stage and it was just like, okay, we'll introduce some people. They'll do 8 minutes, 5 minutes, and then they'll come off. We're emceeing the thing. And then we'll come back out, we'll crack a joke and then introduce the next person. So we introduced you, I guess.
Yeah.
I
got out on stage somehow.
You were out there somehow.
Yeah.
I assume we introduced you, but then when you came back, when you were leaving and we were coming out to stage to introduce the next act.
Yep.
Yeah.
You punched me.
hey, now listen.
It's that simple.
That makes it seem so aggressive. I mean, as I remember it.
And then you kept backstage and I kept going to do my job.
But it happened in my periphery. And you didn't. I didn't. I knew nothing had happened at the time, but you told me later that he gave me kind of like a punch, like a "Hey, do a good job" kind of punch. But it really hurt.
Yeah, it was it wasn't in the face. It wasn't in the chest, like right in the center of the sternum. It was.
He frogged you.
It was on the arm, like
that's
where
what we called it. Did
where
you ever call it a frog?
I've not called it that.
That's what we.
I think
it,
you were aiming for the deltoid.
Yeah,
with a little, like
a little fist bump to the deltoid.
Yeah, fist bump. It was a fist bump motion.
That was the attempt.
But it was a little low. So it was that spot where the deltoid ends, and then the next muscle starts to pick up.
And it got right to the bone.
There's a lot of bone there on me.
Yeah. Well,
I'm bony.
Look, I'm just gonna say, in my defense, I think what happened was the adrenaline
you were jacked
of
up.
Being on stage. Exactly. You know how it can happen. And it was an attempt at a friendly gesture between two performers entering and exiting stage. But I remember upon making the punch that it felt harder than I intended. You know how these things are like, whoa. And then I was leaving the stage and I was feeling like a jerk because I was like, now he's got to go out there and he's got a sore arm.
You had feelings about it.
I sensed immediately. You know, it's like one
you
of those things.
You probably saw my eyes shudder. I was like, oh God.
It's one of those things where you really don't intend it, but you know immediately that you've done it wrong.
Well, so. And I'm sure I didn't help because I do remember having an immediate emotional reaction. Like for some reason, I just, the first like illogical response was like you did it on purpose, which is stupid. Okay.
And I knew that was not the case.
But I'm not gonna try to defend myself with science, but let me try to defend myself with science.
Okay. Gosh.
You hurt me unintentionally, and it was well intended. It was a brotherly
gesture.
Where I'm from, they call it a love lick.
Yeah.
My granddad used to hurt me all the time. Pinch me, punch me, and it was all and it was a love lick. And he said, "I'm giving him a love lick."
Yeah.
That was how he showed affection. Mm-hmm. And I now believe that's what you were doing.
Yeah.
Or you're just being friendly. Let's not make it weird.
Where's the science?
But you hurt me.
You went to granddad real quick.
When it hurt me, we're getting into therapy, not science. I need some help with that. I had a physical pain response that then was like fight or flight. And for some reason, you know me, sometimes I'm like,
oh yeah.
Even though I have no business wanting to fight anybody, like my body said fight.
Wow.
My body said,
this was
a provocation. This
is the part of the story I did not know. I did not know that.
How could you know? How could anyone assume
Link wanted to
that
fight
somebody
you.
Is a total jerk and that would be me in that moment?
Link has wanted it to was fight a bio- me. Link wants to fight me, I'd say every 17 minutes.
It was not.
So don't take it personally.
It was not personal, it was biological.
Right.
It was somebody just hurt me, I'm either gonna run or I'm gonna try to hurt them back.
Mm-hmm. It was your reptilian brain.
It was my reptilian brain.
Well, yeah. I mean, can I say I'm sorry that I didn't mean to hurt, and I'm sorry that you were hurt. And I'm also saying sorry as a Canadian,
which we appreciate at this moment.
The other thing that I would offer to you is an opportunity for a love lick back.
Oh, gosh.
If that is something that you desire, I think it's warranted. It's, you know, it's something that I would permit here.
Can we sell tickets to it, or do we still need to do it right now?
We're going to go Conor McGregor on this thing?
Yeah, I mean, hey, man, they both made $200 million. It's like if we could get a
piece
of
that.
We
do like the YouTube geek off version of that. Like, I have glasses and you know a lot of stuff, so that's really how I'm lumping us together in that way.
Let's let that be a teaser. Let's say, we're not gonna get out of here. We're not gonna let Derek out of here until you give him a love lick back.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say an answer.
Yeah.
An answer about whether.
Well, I'm the fight promoter here. I'm saying it's happening. I'm not gonna set it off at a different date. I don't wanna deal with all the publicity and the pay-per-view stuff. It's just total headache.
So you want me to suspend forgiveness? I mean, the dude said he was sorry for something that he didn't even have to apologize.
This isn't
for.
About forgiveness. This is about revenge. This is about vengeance, man.
I think this is about audience retention. Let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. This is a teaser. You're trying to. Of course, people can just skip to the end and say, hit him back.
I can't do it. I can't let Derek sit over there and say sorry and me not say, I forgive you. I forgive you.
Okay.
But you know what?
I'm still going to hit you.
At the end of the show.
I feel like I should apologize.
No, come on.
Because that's ridiculous. Now, I didn't hold a grudge. I mean, once my logic kicked in, I was like, that made me mad.
Right.
But it would be stupid for me to think that he had Derek had anything to do with it.
Yeah, but
this is a conversation we had.
Logic doesn't always kick in.
But we did have the conversation.
When logic kicks in for Link, it's like an audible noise. It's like a machine turning on.
Oh, that generator that hadn't started in a couple of years is starting up.
Okay, so now that's out of the way and we're gonna do something to the end with it. So what we do often on this podcast is just the two of us talk about things and we don't really know anything about anything, but we like to talk like we do know things about, especially me. I can make you think I know about things.
I'm glad you said that.
I could have an incredible cult following of stupid people. You know, there are people that can do that. I'll be a great cult starter.
That's just not something you say out loud though.
No, but it is true.
It's a little bit like L. Ron Hubbard or something.
Yeah, I would. Like, yeah,
you could actually turn this into something.
Yeah, right. I'm working on my first novel right now.
Okay,
and I got to come up with my version of Dianetics. But
I am the only thing standing in the way of him going over some kind of edge. I won't even give it a label.
But the exciting thing about having you here is that you actually do know stuff.
I know some things. Yeah,
and so this is one of those situations where, instead of just us pontificating about things and then checking ourselves later, and we usually just check ourselves on Wikipedia. I mean, we don't even go to the source.
Sure.
So we're bringing the source to Ear Biscuits. Now, and the cool thing about what you do is that, you know, you kind of started this career on YouTube and now it's gotten a lot bigger than that. And now you've got people like Bill Nye sending you out places to be an official correspondent. So this is legitimate, because here's the thing. You know this as well as we do, that when you get invited to these places and into these environments, but you're the number one qualifier attached to your name as YouTuber, you kind of feel like you have something to prove. We feel like we got something to prove as comedians when we show up in a place, but how do you characterize yourself as a scientist?
Yeah, you know, I'd probably just say YouTuber these days.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
But do you ever feel like you have to like kind of, I'm doing it on YouTube, but it's like this kind of legitimate at the same time.
Yeah. Maybe I've kind of given up on that. You know, when I come through customs and stuff and they'll ask me what I do and I make videos on YouTube and, you know, they actually look at my visa and the technical term for my visa, because I'm not American, the technical term is alien of extraordinary ability.
Oh, gosh. That's incredible.
Right?
Because we won't let you in here unless you can do something that no one here can.
Exactly.
Or something. There's some sort of rationale.
And so when I say to them at the border, you know, I say I'm a YouTuber, and they look at the visa and they're like, what? Extraordinary ability? Like, what can you do?
Let's see it.
And then I have to say, like, I'm on Netflix too. And as soon as I say that,
that's legitimate,
right? I understand.
I'm
like,
on Netflix too.
Depending on who I'm talking to, it doesn't say alien of extraordinary ability, but it says E11.
Now when
category.
When I said let's see it, I was role playing as the guy at the gate.
Oh, okay.
But I am glad you're showing this to me,
because that's what I show the guy at the gate.
E11.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Alien of extraordinary ability. That's probably trademarked in some way. Somebody would want to make a movie about that.
That's a good looking photo. It could be a lot worse.
Yeah, it definitely could.
It could be a lot worse. Okay, so.
So yeah, I understand where you're coming from.
When you mention Netflix, they let you right in.
Right.
That's right. As soon as I say, like, I'm on a show with Bill Nye on Netflix, people are like, oh yeah, he's for real.
Yeah.
I feel it, man. I know.
Yeah.
But you said you've given up, but. Congrats on the streaming win, by the way.
Thank you.
You could say that. I want to stream. I don't know what that
was. Yeah, if I said I want to stream me, they'd still be like, man, that sounds made up.
E11, extraordinary streamy winner.
No.
As long as I keep winning streamies, I'm not going to dog it, though.
No, I'm not going to dog it. I'm going to let John Cozart do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talk a lot about self-driving cars.
Yep.
You know, we're in the middle of the transition.
Yep.
But I think the question,
I would say the beginning of the transition, really.
The
but
beginning of the transition. Yeah. Okay. See, I've already been correct.
It's all good.
But when can we just not think anymore about getting from point A to point B? When is that going to happen?
I think it's going to be a while, but I'm going to say, you know, 5 years. You could probably make it happen. You know, that's my horizon for.
That's quick.
It's soon.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be widespread adoption at that time, but that'll be, you know, your friend has one, or, you know, like, you know, that's when it's really coming in. And then 10 years, you know, you see more widespread adoption. But I think it's going to, you know, 5 years is a good time horizon for that.
And it will be a Tesla. Or by that point.
Do you guys drive Teslas?
No, I wish.
I do drive a Tesla. I drove one here today, and it drove itself most of the way here because I was just on the 101. So,
right. So at what point, I've actually never, let's see, Penna had a Tesla.
A really early one, yeah.
He had an early one, and I rode it, I got in it, but then I didn't even move it. he had to be somewhere. I was like, just let me get in it.
I've been inside a Tesla.
So hang on, you guys have not ridden in a Tesla?
No.
I have not been in a Tesla.
But now John, who works here.
Has one.
Yeah. Has one, so we've got one in the parking lot that we could probably take whenever we wanted.
I don't understand why you guys haven't done this yet. You're sitting around talking about self-driving cars. I know, you haven't even sat in one.
Well, I got a car that will park itself, and I don't want to now get in a Tesla and realize how stupid I am for getting excited about just being able, it'll parallel park itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a useful feature, but it's much more useful to just drive for like half an hour on an open road.
So let's take the trip here as an example of how much of the time, when could you go into autopilot, so to speak?
Well, you can go in whenever you like, but at the moment, the Tesla does not recognize stop signs or traffic lights, so you gotta look out for those things if you're gonna drive in that kind of situation. So the best place is a highway.
Okay.
Because you can just pop it in there and you can go for, you know, an hour or more. You do have to keep sort of touching the steering wheel to let it know that you're still there. I think that's some legal requirement.
Okay, yeah. So it will, after a certain period of time, it will start trying to wake you up.
It flashes at you, yeah, and that time seems to depend on your speed. So if you're on a highway and you're crawling through traffic at like 20 miles an hour, you seem to be able to go, you know, 5-10 minutes without it alerting you. But if you're going super fast, you know, 65-70, it'll ask you probably every minute or so.
But it's still, so when you get off on the surface streets,
yep,
it knows that it's on a surface street and it doesn't even let you engage?
No, you can do it. But you can totally engage on a surface street.
And would it go through a stop sign if you let it?
Yeah, oh yeah. it'll just go up to the car in front of you, basically. And so...
See, but that's... It's informed by all of the other cars. So basically, it's a follower car,
more or less.
So it's not.
But what if there's no car in front of you? Then it's not going to stop for any stop sign. It's not going to stop for any red light. But as long as there's a car in front of you, that car stops at the stop sign. You'll kind of stop behind it too, and you'll do like a kind of a rolling.
Is there an orientation to this?
Like, no, it's totally just like good luck, man. Here
because,
it is.
Because I mean. All I knew is that everybody that I know who has one just does that on the highway. But I didn't know it was because it didn't work on the surface streets. I just thought it wasn't capable of doing it on the surface streets.
Yeah, it'll do it. It just, you'll run into more potential hazards for sure.
Oh man!
But you can't program in a destination and it make any turns for you.
So, the one that's commercially available right now doesn't do that. But Tesla has released a video showing their next generation model doing exactly that. You basically putting in your destination and it just gets you there.
Yeah, that's the time that I want.
That includes stop signs, that includes red lights, and they have the ability to do it today. But it's not been released yet. It's not been, I think, legally permitted yet. But I think, you know, the technology is there today. It's probably still a little rough, but it's there.
Yeah, the thing I don't understand is you know, obviously there's the resistance to it and people who just don't trust it, which I appreciate it, but it really frustrates me when people are like, I don't trust it. And it's like, but you trust humans? You trust people to drive cars? A million people die every year in car crashes?
I think that our consciousness, I think a big thing about consciousness is that it tricks yourself into trusting yourself. Like, even something like, I know, like, this is what I believe. It's like, okay, I heard, you heard that analogy too, where it's like, okay, what do you believe about like if something scares you and then you like jump in the, I'm blistering this analogy, but like
I'm not with you yet.
You jump in the bed and you pull over the covers. And you would never say you believe that a comforter is going to protect you from danger, yet it's revealed in that moment what you actually believe. I think that applies to cars as well. That we, part of consciousness is believing that the most trustworthy person is yourself. But you're saying that's not true when it comes to driving.
But I do wanna have a comforter in my car. That's the whole point. I wanna be able to take a freaking nap. I wanna go to bed in my car and let it drive me.
But so you don't trust yourself to drive. And you're making the active decision to not trust yourself, to trust the machine.
Whoa, I feel like you're framing this in a way that I don't necessarily frame it, which is I find driving just a less stressful experience when I let the car drive. And that's not because I don't trust myself, it's because like I can not really focus on driving as much.
Yeah, well every time,
you can just relax a bit. You don't have to push the pedal, do anything, you know, it's just like, it's just going. Especially if you get stuck in traffic. I mean, it just,
it's a real stressor. For the stressful yet kind of mind-numbing experience of freeway driving, bumper to bumper stuff, you're gonna let the machine take over.
Exactly.
But when it gets complicated, you're gonna grab the wheel.
For now, that is absolutely true.
But at a certain point, there's gonna be a threshold. What's the threshold look and feel like? If you're saying 5 years from now, like,
I think 5 years from now, it's gonna be happening. Because, like I say,
how do we get there?
They have the cars built today.
Yeah, the technology exists.
It's just a matter of fine-tuning it and the software and then getting the legal approval for it. I think the big blockage is that we like a story where it's like, oh, this guy was drunk and he hit someone. It's obviously his fault. He caused these deaths. We can point to someone. We can say someone's wrong and evil. But if there's an autonomous car, and this has happened, right? The guy who got killed driving a Tesla. Mm-hmm. And you know, who do you blame in that situation? And I think we have a real problem with that. If self-driving cars start killing people, well, who are you going to be upset with? Who's at fault there?
Yeah, there's just whatever the equation is. It's like how many, car caused deaths equal a human caused death. It's like we have some weird scale that we're willing to put up with all these people being killed by, you know, themselves in cars.
Well, the interesting thing about that, and the guy who died was behind the wheel of the Tesla, right?
Yep.
But the thing I remember about that is, I don't remember the details of what happened, but I remember that Elon Musk published the details in a super seemingly transparent way that was mind-blowing to me in terms of, hey, this is the actual data. This is actually what was happening and what the car was saying. And the level of transparency there that he seemed to be putting forward, I think, is what's gonna get us over the threshold, because it's not spin. Like, there was nothing about the statement that came out from Tesla afterward that felt like the spin zone, or we gotta protect our money bags kind of a thing. Mm. Do you remember
that? I do. I didn't dig too much into the details, but I seem to recall a stat like, you know, they can look at the miles driven with the autonomous feature engaged and compare that to the same number of miles driven by people, and they find that, you know, it's 40% safer, 40% fewer accidents or whatever per mile for those driven by the machine. So the machine is better. I mean, it's more vigilant with, you know, analyzing what's around it, and people are on their phones all the time now. I was driving behind a guy today who was just like swerving all over the place because he was on his phone.
And probably shaving and reading too.
Exactly.
I mean, I've literally seen that in traffic. You know, to me, it's like whenever you started using PayPal. Remember that first feeling of like, whoa, I'm gonna connect this internet site to my physical bank account? Like, I can see like greenbacks just getting disappearing through this thing called PayPal. It's even a stupid name. Why would I trust this thing?
This guy's not my pal. I just bought something from him.
But then you get over it. And then you're like, when did I not have PayPal or Venmo or whatever it is these days to pay the babysitters? You know?
Yeah.
You're saying it'll be the same way, and you say it'll be 5 years.
5 years, that's what I'm saying.
At some point before the 5 years, you won't even realize that you made a decision. You'll just get in a car and you'll be like, oh, I didn't touch it. And then you'll think back and you'll be like, oh yeah, there was a guy who worked with me who had a cool car and I got in it and it was fun.
Oh yeah, we'll tell
it was fun.
We'll
and it
tell
cool.
our grandkids about the way we thought about driving, and it will blow their minds. They just won't have any They just won't be able to comprehend that it was ever a thing, you know, that we did, that we approached things in this way.
You put those wing doors on it, mm-hmm. and people want to buy
That's not going to happen. Okay, so.
It's already got the wing doors, the Tesla.
That's a fad. That's a fad, man.
That's going away?
The wing doors are great.
You think that's a staple of the future?
I don't think it's a staple, but I do love it.
Yours has that?
We got the wing doors. And it's really helpful for the baby seat, you know.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Now, okay, so you're kind of getting into something as well, though, that as we transition, you know, when all cars are autonomous, with the exception of like, you know, okay, I've got this really weird thing I have to, even beyond that, when it's completely autonomous, so, you know, they're all talking to each other. You know, I can't wait for the day when a light turns green and the entire mass moves together at the same time because there's no reaction because they're all talking together in the same network.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's going to be like second nature, right? But that kind of moves into this other subject that we want to talk to you about, which is your perspective on AI. And, you know, all these things kind of merging. You've got, okay, all the cars are autonomous. All the banking is, I mean, even banking and financial management ultimately can be and should be and is in a lot of ways, you know, controlled by artificial intelligence. So what are we really up against? Like, where do you stand? Are you on the Neil deGrasse Tyson side, which is like, this is no big deal. We'll just unplug the machine. Mm. Are you on the Elon Musk, Sam Harris side? They're like so worried about it that like, this is the greatest problem along with climate change that we face as a species.
I feel like I'm more on the Neil deGrasse Tyson side.
Oh.
But that could just be because, you know, both he and I are scientists and maybe we're not fully immersed in where AI is right now, but I find it hard to believe that I gotta choose my words carefully here because like someone's gonna be playing this tape back for me after the AI apocalypse of like 2030.
You're assuming that you'll be alive.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm hoping that I made it through.
As long as you're there to hear it when they play
it'll
back.
It'll be a robot playing it back. Though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen
as they
to
torture
this.
Me.
Here's what you said.
And their voice would sound like that.
You know, there's a whole bunch of things, obviously not AI, but that we keep contained, like, you know, very dangerous diseases and things. And we put them in, you know, quarantined environments because we don't want them getting out. And I feel like you should be able to do the same thing with an AI. And didn't Facebook have an AI that came up with its own language and they shut it down?
Well, because they started, I don't know if this is the same thing, but there was two machines that were communicating with each other and they quickly realized English, that language, human language was really inefficient and they started just communicating to each other directly with bits, mm-hmm. you know, just straight digital communication.
And at
that point,
it's like, what are they saying?
the scientists could no longer figure out what they were saying. And that is, but it all, it's so crazy because, you know, it's soon.
Pull the plug!
This is why the reason I'm scared, because I mean, I don't.
Are you more on the Elon Musk side?
I am, just because I tend to.
He's a hypochondriac.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm super excited about the future. Like I embrace a lot of things, probably with less apprehension than I should have. But I think that because they're going to be at the moment that they have true, you know, general artificial intelligence, and we can't tell the difference between, you know, a conversation with a human and a robot, they're already going to be so much more advanced than us just because of processing and all that stuff that they already have. And at that point, I just feel like they could, all the barriers that you're talking about, like keeping things contained, it's mm-hmm. like the moment they just decide, well, we don't want to be contained.
But
they will
but
be.
What are they? What are they connected to? Or do they have arms and legs? Have we given them that? Or,
well, they're going to be. I mean, they're going to have to be connected to.
The internet. See, that's a terrible idea.
You know, but how are they going to be?
Guy working in his lab on AI. You know, I think that's the rule. It's like when you go to these places that have really harmful diseases, you have like 3 airlocks and stuff. You don't connect them to the atmosphere because mm-hmm. if they could get out, they would, and that would be awful. In the same way, you keep your AI really locked up.
I don't know how we're going to do it though, because at the point that you've got, again, I don't think it's going to be, well, Westworld situation where you've got, you know, robots walking around that, I mean, what we will have, but that would be just for us, right? It'll be for our entertainment or whatever, but the most powerful robots won't be contained in the same way. but they're going to have
all it
in order to be useful. They're going to have to be connected to a network that we're using.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I feel like you want to be careful about the ones you connect to your network.
Yeah.
This could be the like key plot point of the movie of how this all goes wrong, where someone's
the one
like,
guy, the mad scientist.
Yeah.
What's he mad about?
The one guy who lets the virus out of the lab. And this isn't like a virus, though. You know, it is, but it's way worse.
I still wonder, you know, a server is not going to come after you. You know what I mean? You know, like a giant lumbering server, is that going to be the evil villain here? But I guess, you know, to look at what could go wrong, if everything's connected to the internet and all your, you know, stuff in the hospitals and all the autonomous cars and they get control of those, it could be pretty bad.
Yeah. But who knows? It's gonna happen. We're gonna be in the midst of it, and the thing is that, you know, politicians, the guys who are making the decisions about this stuff, just totally don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've got a few politicians who go like the extra mile to kind of get briefed by some like research assistant, right? But how many people who like hold governmental office actually know the potential threats, right? It's like, and
it's not many, that's for sure. Do you guys ever think about the mass unemployment that may come with the robots?
Well, I
feel like that's a clearly more pressing,
right,
or it's a more imminent issue.
It's already happening.
Yeah, it's happening. I feel like that you're going to deal with first before you're going to deal with killer AI.
Yeah. Hmm.
So we got a set of waves coming at us.
Let's talk about that. I mean, it's interesting. In Buddy System Season 2, we kind of explore, I don't want to give too much away.
Well,
but
it's the first scene. I mean, the first scene of the whole season is you losing your job.
To a robot. Yeah.
Now, it is a comically ridiculous robot who's no more capable than a human.
We're not exploring what we should talk about right now, which is what you're getting at.
But it is the kind of job that we replace. And I mean, number one most common job in the US is truck driver. And Tesla is building a truck that obviously is going to be autonomous at some point. So
I wonder
what
if it's going to have, and at first there'll be somebody sitting there just in case.
Yeah.
They'll work, you know, the laws will require it, right?
Yep.
And he's just going to, like you said, he's going to have to touch that big steering wheel on the big rig every so often. He's just a wheel toucher. That's what he will be called on monster.com. We need some wheel touchers. They're not drivers, they're truck wheel touchers. And then—
But how long is that gonna last?
After a while—
3 years?
Yeah,
they'll be gone.
Yeah.
They'll be gone, but before they're gone, I think that they'll be just seat sitters. And then they will replace the seat sitters with basically like a CPR dummy. Someone who from the outside—
That is never gonna happen.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
No,
big rig barreling down the road. You want to look and see nobody in the cab? You want to see what
you think
is somebody.
Have a mannequin in there.
They're gonna have a freaking mannequin in there with a trucker hat.
How about just a sticker on the outside of the window that just shows the silhouette of a person?
Well, that's not as
believable.
That's
a lot cheaper.
That'll be next. Yeah, you're skipping ahead.
A decal. Can we just go? I'm straight to the decal kind of guy. Let's just do a truck driver decal.
Can I be the decal?
Oh, it could be your profile, sure, I don't care. I'm not making the decisions.
I do think that, so much of this is public perception and comfort level.
But what are those guys gonna do?
If you can make things cool, if you can make—
But the real question is—
That is the bigger question.
What are we gonna do as a population?
As long as we can agree that there will be dummies in seats in order to make everybody else feel okay, then we can move on.
I feel like that's more frightening. Like you're driving up next to a truck and you look over and you're like, wait, hang on, that's not a real person, that's a dummy.
Well, it depends on your definition of beauty. Is that what we're talking about now?
Yeah, oh gosh.
What makes a dummy beautiful?
No, we're not talking about
that.
I don't think that's it.
So do you think that, I know some people think that, you know, they'll just be the decal guy. They'll be the guy who places the mannequin in the truck. There's always something for people to do. But
the new job.
You got to run out of that eventually, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, something that I was really interested to see looking back at the history of work is that the number of hours that we work has dropped a lot. So if you look in 1830, the average number of hours that someone would work would be 70 hours per week.
Really?
Yeah. And you look today, and it's down to 40. And, you know, in 20 years, we may be down to 20 hours or something. You know, we may continue to see that decline. So maybe even if the, you know, number of jobs doesn't decrease that much, the amount of work per job may drop. And we may just be making more and or spending less because all the work's being done by robots, which are much cheaper than humans.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the hopeful utopian future, is that we could all decrease our work hours down close to zero and yet still survive and have, you know, wonderful lives because all the things that we want to buy are really cheap. And so we don't have to do that much work to get the money to pay for those things.
But what are we like? Mm. So what are the threats to that utopia, right? You got the overpopulation problem, right?
Yeah.
Eventually you've got so many people, like I feel like the financial problem can be solved. Like the people not producing, it's like, well, the robots are producing. What about this being that many people, limited amount of resources, and all we do is just hang out and have a good time?
Yeah. Well, to me, one of the big threats is that we sort of segment our society further into people who have and the have-nots.
You know? Yeah.
There are going to be people who are making a killing off this, and there's going to be people who just are out of work and can't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think without like a big rethink of how society functions, we may be in a really tricky situation.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about universal basic income?
I think it's interesting, and I think it's probably the way of the future.
How does that work?
Well, you just give everyone some money.
Yeah, there's a minimum amount that every single citizen receives automatically.
From what organization?
From the government.
From what government? The world government?
Whatever government that you're
Every nation. We assume the nations still exist.
And they would have to buy into this.
Well, I mean, the nations would, in theory, do it because it would be better or easier than setting up a whole bunch of other welfare systems.
Yeah.
It's
being experimented with somewhere.
Finland, they've currently got a trial with 2,000 unemployed people where they just picked 2,000 unemployed people at random and they said, we're going to give you like 500 euros a month.
Yeah. But yeah, it seems absolutely inevitable with the trends that we're talking
about. It's funny because you say it seems inevitable, and I kind of think it's a good idea, but I was in Switzerland last year, and they actually had a ballot about it. So this is one of those things where, you know, if you get enough signatures, they'll have a public referendum about universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
And they did this in Switzerland, and they voted it down, I think, 75-25 against.
Yeah.
So it was pretty harshly against. And I was talking to this guy at a university who's a smart guy, you know, professor, and he was like, this is the most idiotic thing ever. And, you know, to him, it was obvious that this was never going to happen. And, of course, the great concern with universal basic income is that nobody works anymore because they can just get income and live off that. And so why would you ever
work? And that's,
so the idea of disincentivizing any work.
Right.
And well,
and that's why I think it's inevitable, because I think it's getting it mixed up. It's saying that well, we can't institute universal basic income because then people will no longer work. Well, what I'm saying is that people are going to no longer work in the near future because of the advance of, you know, automation.
Mm.
And so you got to have an answer to that. And it can't just be like, well, these people won't work. It's like, I mean, I don't
Yeah. I was looking into this, actually. I made a recent video about robots taking our jobs, and I was looking at the percentage of males between the ages of 25 and 54 who don't have a job. And if you look back in the 1960s, it's about 5 or 6%. You know, this is prime working age males, so like, what are they doing if they're not working?
Mm-hmm.
But you look more recently, and that's up towards 18 to 20%. So we're looking at a tripling of males in their prime working age who just don't have a job.
Mm.
And some of that may be due to globalization, outsourcing, another part of that is automation.
Mm.
So I can only see that going up. So, you know, you got to do something.
Well, let's say that utopia is going to come. We're going to solve all our problems with technology, and we're going to find a way to quit exploiting all the resources. We're going to solve climate change. Let's just say all that happens. And our grandkids are sitting there. They've got some sort of stipend. Everything, all their needs are taken care of. At that point, what is life like, right? Because I think we can definitely say that we find purpose in our work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you do what you do because you find purpose in it. I wonder, just substituting other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone could, they could just have hobbies instead of work.
I'm gonna do the little airplanes.
Like making little airplanes?
Balsa wood?
You're on that side of town. You know the guys over at, where are they at?
Across in the Japanese garden.
Yeah, over there in Balboa, the Balboa Lake area. The guys with the
remote control planes.
Airplanes.
I have not seen this.
There's a whole airport dedicated to, you know, miniature planes.
Those guys are so serious.
Hang on. A whole airport? Is it a miniature airport?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay,
it's a miniature airport.
It's just a slab, really. But they're so into it, and they go out there every weekend.
There's no terminals. It looks more like baseball dugouts.
Okay.
Because sometimes they need to stand in the shade in order to glare up.
But here's the weird thing.
Squint up at the sun and like pilot their planes.
But
I mean, if you lay down on your belly and spread your arms out, if you got spread eagle on the floor,
mm-hmm.
they have
planes that big. Oh yeah,
it's a pretty big plane.
Ironic thing.
These are like gas powered.
Some of them are.
Yeah.
Some of them are electric.
Hmm.
But here's the thing.
I think they're all powered by passion for the hobby.
We can't just go out and do that, because then all of a sudden a guy's going to show up and he's like, I've got an automatic plane. I've got an autonomous plane. And
yeah,
then now it's just a bunch of dudes watching autonomous planes.
No.
You can't even have a hobby. We're going to watch planes make their own decisions, and that's our hobby? All we can do is put decals on them. See, it just comes back to decals.
Why is that plane shooting down all the other planes?
I don't know.
Find the owner.
I have no
Some
control
Some robot
over
in the
it.
Corner.
So this is your idea of a utopia.
Well, we're exploring it, you know?
Yeah,
if you're saying everyone does hobbies.
I wonder if people get caught up in gossip, if that just explodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a number of gossip mags out on the market, it's just, you know, it's everywhere. Whole store is dedicated to it. I guess not stores, you just get it delivered.
Nope, you're right.
Yeah.
Stores. I think it'll be a retro thing where it's like, it's a whole store that replicates the experience of exiting a grocery store. You know, all of that impulse buy crap. This is a good idea. This is my business. No robot's gonna come up with this in the future. A store that's nothing but the last little bit of grocery aisle before you check out. The checkout rack.
Checkout area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Checkout area everywhere is what I'm gonna call
okay,
it.
Okay, that's catchy.
And then when you come in, you check out. When you get in, you check out again. You just keep checking out, because it's like, oh man, I gotta make a decision. I can grab one more thing. And then it starts over.
Yeah.
And then you just-
You got all those little dividers and you could be, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, you're okay. Yeah, those
you,
wanna, you love
invest
the dividers.
This is a great business idea.
Let's check out area,
but it's
everywhere,
retro
yeah.
because you're right. It would all be digital. It'd all be in your brain.
But there's no aisles. There's no area to actually buy
right.
like the useful staples of life.
Right.
There's only the checkout area.
I'm
some
basically describing
some...
a dollar store, I think. But
yeah,
let's gloss over.
You
that.
Recreated a dollar store.
A lot more conveyor belts. Is what we're saying.
Now, I think one of the interesting things that is probably also going to happen with this is, and this is what I kind of foreshadowed this in the past. I was going to, and how I thought about AI and how it, you know, I don't know how I set it up, but basically, I think that, you know, we've got all these issues that are controversial. People can't agree on things, and then we've got this faulty government model that we rely on with a questionable dude in charge of the whole thing. And wouldn't you just like to say, okay, I want to ask this robot that is completely familiar with all the data, like, what do you think about this issue? And then they would just spit it out, and it would be like, oh, I can't argue with that robot, because that robot has access to all the information at once and is perfectly rational and has no bias at all, except the bias that makes its way in from the programmers, which, okay. But
well, I think you're describing a scientist. In its purest form.
But you know, but scientists are people, and so you
right.
have that inherent distrust of people. But I think, you know, since scientists make the machine, I don't know if there's any way to keep their biases out of the machine. And therein,
right.
therein lies your problem, which
is
like...
It is a problem, but can't it be a more perfect rationality than we can ever achieve, right? What I'm getting at is, aren't we going to have an AI government at some point? Or at least a government that is assisted by AI. So in other words, it would probably be
You know how quick governments are to adopt technology. they're always the early adopters.
This is distant future. So you've got like
It's gotten. I think your point is to move. It's like for the financial system thing.
Well, if you
is
did,
that it, things have to get really bad for entire governments to agree to do something. You're talking about the Switzerland
vote.
Well,
just think about the way that the government works right now. Think about the way that people get elected and like campaigning and like influencing people's thoughts. People who the vast majority don't ever think about things on a deep level. They just go out and vote for somebody who has an ad that appeals to them in some way or some ideology that they identify with, and that person gets put in this position. They don't know about this issue and that issue, and then they just start listening to people who don't know about that issue tell them what they're supposed to think about that issue, and it's all these very, very flawed humans making all these decisions. Like that system, in when you've got an intelligence that is ultimately a more capable intelligence that is growing, at some point you're gonna have to tap into that for the sake of humanity, right?
I'm not into Star Trek enough to know more than saying, you're talking about Spock. I mean, let's figure out, Spock was like utterly logical.
Spock for president.
So what do we learn? Yeah, what do we learn from Spock?
Sometimes his logic wasn't enough. That's what we learn.
That's why you have the panel of people who are keeping the AI government in check. I'm not saying it's completely
autonomous.
Touching the
steering wheel.
But then they're like, hold on, okay, we need to know what to think about this. Let's throw the problem into the machine, see what the machine says, and then this panel of wise people decides what to do. So it's not completely led by the AI, but you gotta be consulting it,
so
right?
So you're saying it's not the president, it's like the cabinet, and I mean literally a cabinet.
Like the president's chief advisor is AI.
Is a cabinet.
A literal cabinet?
Yeah.
With a server in it.
Yeah, it's like throw it in the top of the cabinet and then it'll spit something out of the bottom, an answer out of the bottom
right.
of the cabinet.
Yeah.
It sounds like a cool idea. I always just fear about that whole, you know, garbage in, garbage out kind of problem of technology where if you don't phrase the question right or you don't give it the right data, you're not gonna get the right thing out at the end. So
right.
It's still kind of troubling. And I'm also—
This morning, my son Lando, who's 7, was like, okay, Google, play the Slinky song, because he was playing with a really big Slinky. Mm. And it started playing a really inappropriate R&B track.
Mm.
By
slinky,
some guy
slinky
named
song.
By Slinky or something. And I was like, whoa, Google. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to rein her in.
I also wonder, you know, when do we get an artificial intelligence that is, you know, truly deserving of that name? Like, to me, artificial intelligence always meant something that was a computer that had its own consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know that we're close to that. And I also don't know that anyone can time that out for you. Like, oh, we're not there yet, but give us 5 years, we'll be there, or 10 years.
It
could be 100 years, could be 1,000 years, because we don't know how the human brain works yet. I think it's really tough to make something that replicates those capabilities.
Right, we actually don't know how we're gonna cross that threshold. Right?
And we've always been obsessed with it. I mean, Frankenstein wasn't written a few years ago.
No.
I don't know when it was written, don't ask me, but I know it's old. You know, it's as long as we've been conscious, we've been obsessed with creating consciousness. So I think, if we're this driven,
we're
bound to figure it out.
Do you think we're gonna get there?
Just based on that principle alone, like just drive.
What if it's impossible? What if it's impossible to replicate in a machine, you know,
that is a spiritual question.
Biologically.
That is a spiritual question. I have no clue. It's a very fair question.
My feeling on this, and this is just going with my gut, which could be totally wrong, right? Because it's not a thinking organ, but but really, I just don't feel like we're gonna get there, and certainly not soon. But
I definitely don't think it's gonna be soon. Mm. So I don't think it's gonna be like 2045 or something. You know,
the singularity,
right? But I don't know. I just feel like I think that, you know, I don't think it's gonna be like somebody's gonna walk out one day and be like, I got it, I got this, this, here it is, talk to it.
Here he is, Frankie.
I think it's gonna get so close, and we're gonna have intelligent conversations with machines, and then after a while we're gonna be like, well, we've kind of given this machine all we can give it, and I kind of think that it's conscious now. But well, it's at the same time, we're gonna be, I mean, we keep trying to find where consciousness exists, right? In us, like, where's the self inside a brain?
And we have no idea.
We have no idea. So I don't know. I agree with you that I don't think that it's, I don't think it's gonna happen in our lifetime. I really don't. I think things will get unrecognizable in our lifetime, technology-wise, but I don't think it's gonna, we're not gonna have, you know, AI president.
Well, let me ask you, what are you most excited about the future, and it can be the distant future, and what are you most concerned about? Maybe that's climate change, maybe that's something else.
Wow, tough questions, because I mean, I don't often think about the distant future, but I do like the idea of humans becoming a multi-planetary species.
Oh, let's save the good, start with the bad, because I want to end with
okay.
the good.
Okay, great. Oh,
so we'll come back to that one.
Start with the bad. Yeah, it's tough to pick. What's your biggest concern? I'm not a big worrier, so I don't have a lot of concerns. What about you guys?
You pack quite a punch, though.
Well,
see,
it doesn't come from a place of hate.
You
tend to
be violent under some circumstances.
It only comes from a place of love.
Maybe I haven't fully forgiven you. I don't know why that came out.
It did. It does seem like it right now. I can feel the tension across this table. Yeah. What are the biggest problems?
Being a guy like you are, and being an expert in the things that you are in this particular, like in America, right? Like, we have this really weird sort of dichotomy of like being super advanced and like world leader, but then we also have like, there's so much resistance to scientific thinking, and also a lot of resistance to just scientists in general, and a lot of distrust. You know, like where we come from, North Carolina, it's just like, scientists are suspects, and scientists have agendas, and scientists are trying to get grants, and so that's the only reason they're talking about climate change or this
right.
or that, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a diverse country. You can say that. I also saw this study which looked at opinions of scientists in countries around the world, and there was a clear negative correlation between GDP, you know, how developed a country was, and its perception of scientists. So countries that are still developing, they love scientists and have this idea that they are solving problems and really helping everyone live better lives. And in countries where, you know, they're already very developed, everyone's quite skeptical of scientists. So I think it's interesting that sort of the more benefit science gives you, the more you don't like it or trust it or, you know, think it's a great thing. It's kind of unfortunate. I consider this sometimes like the curse of prevention. This applies to things like vaccines, where people don't know what the disease is like, and so they freak out about, you know, a shot, because they can't even see, like, what am I preventing?
Right.
So yeah, that is the curse of prevention, doing all this good stuff. I think, you know, everyone has biases, and they really cloud your judgment. And so when you talk about, you know, people distrusting scientists, it comes from a place, I think, of, you know, not wanting to be told what to do, and being told that what you do is wrong and hurting the planet, and that you have to change, and that's going to be painful and expensive and hard, and, you know, for something that seems very intangible and deep in the future and invisible. So I can really understand where this is like a Rorschach test, where, you know, even the people on the pro, you know, we need to do something about climate change side can maybe be somewhat detached from the evidence. And people on the anti side are also detached from the evidence, and they just battle in the middle over, you know, some sort of ideological or, you know, virtue signaling ground or identity politics, all that sort of stuff. So everything gets really, really awful, I think.
Well, and it seems like, and it's interesting because, you know, Bill Nye is really, he tends to insert himself into these things.
For sure.
It doesn't really matter what issue it is. He is doing a lot of great things, but at the same time, there's this, when he says, okay, I'll go and I'll debate this guy, or I'll go on this network and it'll be me and then this other guy, and it creates this false perception that this is a real, there's a real debate to be had here. And I'm not saying there's not a debate to be had about issues, but sometimes when you just reduce it down to two pundits, you know, and these, you know, what do you call it? The news bit, what do you call the thing?
Talking heads,
but like you got a news bite or whatever, like a
sound bite.
Yeah, reduce things down to sound bites. It paints the issue wrong for a lot of people, and, mm-hmm. and gives you this idea that, you know.
I don't know. I mean, I agree with you. I just don't know who's, you know, what other alternative
What do
there.
You do?
It's like you have no option, because either Bill goes on that show and actually debates some guy, or that guy just pontificates by himself.
That's
and,
true.
And gives the same sort of bad talking points. Yeah, it's a really tough one.
Because the networks are going to still do it. I mean, they're going to do that. That's how they're going to dispense the information.
Yeah. This kind of makes me think of something, a little bit of a tangent, but the people on the, you know, pro-climate change side, I don't know, pro-climate change, the people who think this is an issue and they want to do something about it, sometimes
climate change acknowledgers?
Yeah, acknowledgers. They will sometimes write inflammatory rhetoric. There are some people like Naomi Klein, and I haven't read her book about climate change, but I have read the back cover of it, and it basically says that, you know, climate change is an indication that our system is not working, that capitalism has failed, and that, you know, we need a massive revolution to, you know, change everything, and, you know, let's harness this issue as an opportunity to change everything the mm-hmm. way we want it to be. And I can understand that freaking out people, you know, who don't have that sort of ideology, and really getting their backs up and making them more suspicious of, you know, what scientists are talking about. So in a way, I feel like stuff like that does a real disservice when you're trying. Like, I would love for us all just to come down to the fundamental issue of raising the temperature of the planet by a couple degrees, which I don't think is a contentious issue scientifically. And then thinking about that as kind of a risk factor. There's a guy who's a kind of lobbyist for Republicans, and I love the way he sort of talks about it, which is, we acknowledge this as a potential risk for the future, and you don't know how bad it's going to be. It might be really, really bad, or it might just be like kind of bad. But banks, for one, have a lot of experience with dealing with potential risks in the future. And what do you do when you have a risk which, you know, has a small probability of being terrible? You hedge against it, and you mm-hmm. sort of pay in a certain amount up front to make sure that never happens, because if it did happen, you know, there's nothing you could do that would make you whole. So it's fundamentally this sort of it's a risk management game. And he's trying to talk to people and say, like, who cares how bad you think this is going to be, and who cares, you know, how much you really acknowledge this. Mm-hmm. Consider that it is a risk, that it is something with uncertainty, which everyone acknowledges. And what do you do in the face of an uncertain risk? Take steps to mitigate it. And that's where I'd love to see us go, is this place where we acknowledge it as a risk, some uncertainty in the future, and something that we should probably take some measures to prevent.
Right, and you're mm-hmm. and you're saying that right now the two sides of the debate are alarmism,
yep.
and kind of demonizing anybody who questions it, and then people who just deny it.
Yep.
And those are the two camps. And so where's the action gonna take place? If we just be like, well, guys, something could be happening, and that something that's happening could be really bad. And what can we do? What are the practical steps that we can agree on, you know? I think that's a pretty reasonable perspective.
I'd love for us to get there. I feel like media has made things, and I kind of refer to the internet and social media has mm-hmm. all made this much worse. Hmm. It's funny to think, like, where would we be policy-wise if it was 1999 now? You know what I mean? In terms of technology and everything. We didn't have Twitter or Facebook or YouTube. Obviously, we wouldn't be here. But mm-hmm. But if you know what I mean, like, the internet's allowed people to find their
voice.
Well, and also the people like them.
Oh, yeah.
And really get into these camps.
Oh, yeah.
Would we be more integrated if we had fewer communications technologies?
Yeah, that is the really ironic thing that's happened. We're more connected and more divided than ever. I was talking with somebody about this the other day, and we were talking about we thought about issues, you know, in the 80s or how we learned about things. And it was just like, there's a couple of people that knew stuff. There's a couple of outlets. And of course, in one sense, that information was controlled by people who may have been deceiving the public. But in another sense, it's like you didn't have this like, this is my guy, this is my internet guy, this is the website I go to, and these are the people who have it right.
And that's right. And I also feel like people had a greater sense of integrity for some reason. Maybe it was out of this false notion that they couldn't push the envelope too far. You know, like even if someone was controlling the news, you know, back in the 80s, they would never dream of like putting on false stories or anything because, you know, that's ridiculous. Who would ever do? No, we have some integrity. And then these days, you know, it's like anyone could put anything out there and then it can blow up without anyone's oversight. Mm-hmm. So that's a really scary position to be in. I also think, you know, media has made it so there's a big market if you want to be extreme on this side or extreme on this side.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of a market for the middle.
Right.
And that's really kind of unfortunate, and I think does the a massive disservice to the entire discourse.
Well, it's interesting because podcasts have kind of changed this in one sense. It's like I think about that all the time when I'm listening to people talk about complex issues on podcasts. I'm like, this would never happen on the news.
Oh yeah,
like you'd never get into something like that and actually hear somebody break something down.
Yeah, not a sound bite, a sound meal.
Sound meal.
A sound meal.
That's what we should have called.
Perhaps
this podcast.
A biscuit.
Maybe that's what your biscuit actually means, Link. Sound meal.
But let me shift gears to the speculative distant future that you are most excited about. Like it could be an autonomous beard trimmer.
Well, he said interplanetary travel. That's what he
said. Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. You know, multiplanetary species, that's my vision for the future. And it's also really that thing of liberation from work, which is something we kind of talked on earlier in the podcast. But you think about the history of humans as a species, and from the very earliest times, you know, we've been about doing the fundamental work needed to survive, you know, getting food and taking care of, you know, family and stuff. And that's about all we had time for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move through the agricultural revolution and you start to get, you know, artists and writing and poetry and, you know, things start to enrich our lives and move through the Industrial Revolution and the number of people who can do those sorts of things really increases. And now we're going through, you know, further revolutions with this technology. And so I'm imagining a future where people don't think about, you know, what is my job so that I can pay for a living and I can support a family. Yeah. I can, you know, find food. You're thinking about people who really pursue their interests and their passions, and they have the freedom to do that and also do it in space.
Yeah, replacing desperation with hobbies.
Is that how we're going to overcome, you know, the population problem, is going to other planets?
Oh, I'm optimistic that we can support everyone on Earth.
Right.
You know, there may be a few more billion, but again, you look at the massive trends of the last, you know, few thousand years, and it is reducing the amount of work, and it's also having fewer babies in developed countries.
Right, yeah, the birth rate goes down.
Yeah, so. I'm hoping that we see that, you know, I think we're already seeing it, the birth rate starting to level off in a lot of places. And so hopefully we reach a point and, you know, we have the capability and the technology to produce enough food. And, you know, I think it is possible. But I think, you know, for the long-term survival of the human species, it's a good idea to be on multiple planets. And I also think, you know, space exploration would be one of my top goals. If I was in government, it wouldn't be growing the military. It would be growing the NASA budget.
So what about getting to these, I mean, Mars is one thing, right? But
are you not excited about Mars?
No.
Are you I'm waiting for Pluto?
Well, no. You know, we went to JPL and they let us walk around the Mars yard, and it was, I mean, I gotta say, it was pretty underwhelming. I mean, just kind of a dirt.
I mean, it is Pasadena. It's, you know, it's not Mars.
Right.
To be fair.
So.
Well, it's a dirty back lot.
But if that's what Mars is gonna be like, I'm like, well, what about the Earth-like planets that we can actually get to?
Wow.
Right?
Yeah, because we can't get to any right now.
Right.
So we're gonna have to figure out some tech if we're gonna get to.
So yeah, how are we gonna do that? Like, what's the closest one that they've discovered? Like, how many light years?
I mean, 20 light years is probably your best bet. In terms of Earth-like planets.
And so even that is this going to be, are we in a, what is it? What's the movie where Chris Pratt's
was
on
that
the-
Passengers?
Yeah, Passengers. So is it that kind of situation where we got people in some sort of, you know.
Cryogenic freezing.
Some state and we just, it's just, we're propelling them across the universe.
I feel like the first thing we'd send is robots. Did they send robots first in that movie? I haven't seen that.
I heard it was bad. I didn't watch it.
Yeah, I heard it was bad too.
It just started in the middle of the journey, so there's no robot.
Right. I wonder if you just send a colony, you know, a group of people who could live and like have kids and they could have kids and by the time you get there, you know, it's your fifth grandchild who settles on the place. But your other option, you know, the crazy thing about relativity is that if you go fast enough, the distance gets shorter. Mm-hmm. This is the crazy thing about special relativity. So, for example, if you could go nearly the speed of light, 0.999, the speed of light, mm-hmm. then to someone on Earth, it would seem to take about 20 years to get that distance, you know, for that person to arrive there. But for the people inside the spacecraft, it would actually take much less time.
Right.
This is the crazy fact.
But how are we going to get that fast?
Well, that's the key. We got to find a good energy source, and that's probably going to be something like fusion. Mm-hmm. Could be fission. It's probably going to be fusion, nuclear fusion. So the same thing that powers the sun.
Doesn't sound dangerous at all.
Right, but I mean, people are working on it right now.
Yeah.
They're trying to get a reactor up in Europe right now to actually make power out of fusion. So the same thing as happens in the sun, just combining hydrogen atoms together, squeezing them together, making helium and other sorts of things.
And that's happening?
Yeah, people are working on it. In fact, they've been working on it for decades. The problem that they've been having is they put so much energy in to heat the particles up and get them, you know, ready to do their fusion thing,
mm-hmm.
That they actually get less energy out of the fusion process.
Oh, okay.
So it's an input-output issue. Right. But I think we're very close to that sort of tipping point, inflection point, where we're actually going to start getting more out than we put in.
Well, and at the moment that you reach that point, doesn't that basically just... that becomes our energy? I mean, you don't even need solar at that point.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's like solar on Earth. You're making your own star kind of thing. But actually getting the technology to be affordable and, you know, stable, easy to use, that, you know, it'll take time.
So it's kind of like showering so hard that you make yourself stink.
I don't know that I get that.
Yeah.
If you expend so much energy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you go hard in the shower. You got to be careful.
Right.
I've never contemplated this.
Don't go hard in the shower.
I don't go hard. I take it easy. I just lay back.
Right. Take a tub bath, man.
Oh, man.
You got to get out more than you put in.
That's right.
You don't want to stink coming out of the shower.
Definitely not. This is a question I've often had with my friends, like swimmers, when they go in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Do they sweat?
Oh, gosh.
See?
And can they answer the question?
I don't know.
I'm no swimmer. I'm not friends with swimmers.
All I got to do is take a sample, man.
But how do you do it? I mean, they're wet anyway.
That's a good video for your channel.
Yeah,
man.
It is.
Do swimmers sweat? Hey, title, thumbnail, everything.
It's
right
all
there.
Done. It's all
but
done.
Can we collab on the Go Hard in the Shower?
Yeah, we'll do Go Hard in the Shower.
That's a good title.
On our channel.
And then it's just total clean science.
It's not what you think it is. Yeah,
that'll right. get yeah. clicks.
That's a good one.
Okay. Well, Derek, this has been a great conversation. Of course, we can't just end it here because we promised that you guys would settle your score.
Yeah.
You guys.
So why don't, before you settle your score, remind everybody where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me with the word Veritasium. It's
everywhere.
Yeah.
I can't even say it now. Veritasium.
You can't even say it because of the anger. It's because of the anger that is deep inside you.
Veritasium is found wherever it's found. It's you.
Yeah.
Hopefully no one's impersonating you.
No one's. I got that trademarked.
So what? you want me to punch him?
Yeah.
To end the podcast?
I want you to give him a love lick. I want you to give him a love lick.
It would make you feel better, I think. Just getting that energy out.
You think that I
this would close
tense,
the circle. You know what I'm saying?
I got so much pleasure out of turning this into entertainment for everybody that I feel like I can't punch
you. Well, you could hug him real hard.
Hug it out? Listen, I'm going to put it this way. I'm not going to, I have no revenge in my heart. I have only love and forgiveness and respect.
Wow.
And I just consider it an honor to have been punched by the hand that held the world's smoothest object.
Roundest object.
Roundest.
Yes.
Okay, well, you know what I mean.
It was the most perfect sphere.
It was the most spherical.
Yes. And you screwed it up when you
it. Wasn't
it.
Smooth?
Well, of course, it has to be smooth in order to be the roundest.
But it's not the smoothest?
Well, that is a question.
That's a baby's right. Bottom.
We'll collab on that, too.
So you're not going to hit him?
No, I'm not going to hit him. That's stupid. I mean, they're still listening. Mission accomplished.
Okay.
But now we let him down.
Yeah.
because, see, this is him, man. This is him playing producer. And it's not really.
I'm
not
Don
really fair.
King, man.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna
Dana.
Look at that. We're shaking
I'm
it
Dana
out.
Dana White.
Audio listeners, we're giving it a nice semi-firm handshake.
Yeah, squeeze it, Link.
There's some vibrational energy happening there.
Wow. Yeah. I love the science on this podcast. It's fantastic.
I love how this is fizzling out too. The forgiveness gives a good fizzle.
It does.